G'day, folks. Talk to Senator Jordan Steele John, a Greens politician straight out of WA, wheeling around the corridors of Parliament in Canberra. It's an interesting yarn, talking about how he found politics, what it means to him, the party that he represents, himself as a person with disability, with CP, cerebral palsy, broadcasting his thoughts and feelings through the portfolios that he represents, with health, disability rights and services, foreign affairs, peace and nuclear disarmament, and just seeing his advocacy and passion about the NDIS, the good, the bad and the ugly, stripped back bare with his hashtag, fix the NDIS. And I'm glad there's someone like Jordan, a person of power, that can broadcast his voice for the people with disability that can and can't talk. He's doing solid work. And I look forward to see what he's going to be doing in the future as a senator, as a politician, federally. Solid. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe or follow button. And we've also got a Patreon page. The link is within the description. So if you want to roll with the squad and become a patron, that'd be great. I want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Senator Jordan Steele. Jordan Steele, John, how are you, brother? And really appreciate you jumping on the podcast and willing to have a yarn with me, mate.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here, my friend, and thank you so much for inviting me to be part of it.
And, Senator, before we get into a lot of the good, solid work that you've done, what you do, and looking into the future, just want to look at life began before you got into the political realm.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, I had the opportunity to reflect on this a lot during the last, particularly during the last couple of months, because we've been doing a bit of work really focused a lot on healthcare and how to expand universal healthcare services to people in Australia. And as part of doing that work, it's really brought me back to a lot of the stuff in my childhood where I had to interact with the healthcare system a lot, you know, not only as a disabled person, but also as a member of a family that had a lot of struggles, has a lot of struggles still with physical, acute health problems, and also mental health as well. And it's a weird thing when you do work in politics, if you like, and I've got the health portfolio for the Greens, and you often end up talking about something like healthcare in this weird kind of sanitized, like canned political way. You say things like, I am committed, or the Greens are committed to a 10-year action plan, so blah, 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 blah. And there's not a lot of humanity in it. No one actually speaks like that. And it's weird for me to even use the phrase politician in relation to myself, because I've been an MP now for 5 years, but it was never what I thought I was going to do. Nobody in my family is an MP or is involved in politics in any way. And when I think about why I started to get interested in politics in my kind of late teenage years, it was actually as a distraction. Like distraction from what was going on in my life at the time. And if I look at it, it was part of a series of distractions that is kind of like a through theme of my childhood and adolescence, was looking for distractions from what my life was like. And before it was politics, I was fascinated and deeply buried in everything to do with space, you know, about as far away from planet Earth as you could possibly get. And then before that, I was a Mad King dino kid. So about as far back in time as it's, you know, possible for you to conceptually go as a child. And the reason I was doing that was because my family, because of those health and mental health challenges, were actually really struggling. You know, the background noise to my childhood was an intense amount of stress, as my mum particularly had to fight almost constantly against either the medical system or the mental health system to get me the health-based supports that I needed, or my dad to get the mental health supports that he needed, or my brother to get the health supports that he needed. And it was never easy. It was always, you had to engage in fierce, determined, continued advocacy to get anything like the supports that were needed from the system, and that wears you down after a time. And it wore us down, and the only way that we were able to get through it as a family was at a critical moment after some pretty horrible health stuff happened with both my mum and my dad in quick succession. My nan and my pop moved in with us, so we all kind of lived together. And I think that was the moment when it really gives you a clear idea that there is power in people coming together to help each other. In fact, in moments of crisis, that's the only way you really get through, is pulling together. Like, that was the only way that we got through. And like, we were very lucky in context. Like, my mum was a social worker in the UK for 20 years, so she was uniquely set up to navigate administrative systems, but, you know, really couldn't do it. So all of those things, I think, sparked in me
and that'd been tricky for mum too. So that's seeing it within her own family structure, but obviously going to work and seeing that out in the open community as well, and working within that environment.
Well, I mean, definitely, absolutely. I mean, mum had spent her entire professional life helping kids that were, you know, subjected to the most incredibly horrific abuse, and then was kind of struck down by some really horrible health stuff herself, couldn't do that job anymore. And around about the same time, me and Harry came along, then you've got to take those skills and put them to work for your family. But still, so many barriers, so much frustration, so much pushback when you're trying to get your, you know, kid with CP the support they need before the NDIS even existed, or get the right medical treatments, or those kind of things. And I think every time I watched either my mum or my pop or my nan or my brother bang up against a system that was pushing back on them when it was actually created in the first place to help people, you know, to give people healthcare or to give people mental health support or to provide disability support, every single time that happened, or happened to a friend or extended family member, that lit a bit more of a fire in me of now this has got to change. These systems need to work for people. These systems need to help people. These systems need to challenge they need to flag unmet need and meet that unmet need rather than engage people in resources. And it just so happened that becoming distracted by politics, if you like, picking that as the next escape route in many ways, led me to a political movement in the Greens and political involvement, political campaigning, that actually gave me an avenue to be like, okay, you can remake these systems. They can be made better for people.
100%. And I can see the correlation now, like, with what you've gone through, and you're looking at those distractions, and then you're also looking what's going on with general family life. And I think that's where a lot of individuals all over, they forget about the ripple effect of, yes, you've got the person with, you know, whether it's that disability, that health condition, but how that affects the whole family structure, the community. Like, there's so much going on. It's so multi-layered. Absolutely. And that's, yeah, and I can see where that fire's burning and where that's led you into politics and, you know, where, and it, you know, there would have been also a, you know, that's also a healthy distraction in regards to if you went down the Neil deGrasse Tyson route as well, you know. So, but in saying that, you know, it's important, like with yourself, being in the position that you are and being a voice, but having the power that you've got as well. But, and that's, you know, a good healthy dose of power. But has it, and going down that political route and yourself coming from, you know, the Northern Hemisphere, coming down here down under as a young fella.
Yeah.
And so what led the Greens and having some of the inspiration from that, whether it was that party or just individuals linked up to it somehow. So what led you down to the path of the Greens and that political party?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's a combination of things. One is the very strong social justice kind of commitment that comes from my mum particularly and her work in social work, and that idea that, like, no system exists because that's how it neutrally popped into being. It's a result of the decisions made by people in positions of power. And often those decisions are made to empower or to entrench the already held power of one group at the expense of another. And actually, those systems of power can be challenged and remade so that they work more effectively for the people that actually are being impacted by their current structure. So that was certainly very clearly there from Mum. And the Greens are very committed to social justice and to a unashamedly bold and radical interpretation of what social justice needs to look like in terms of fundamentally remaking that status quo rather than attempting to incrementally shift it, if you know what I mean. So that's one. And then the other is the understanding that I came to, you know, after getting involved in politics, that there's such a deep connection between the environment and human beings and human needs. They're interconnected. There can be no separation between the two. Climate change is a great example of that, but so is so are many other environmental challenges, whether it be the issue of, like, plastics in our ecological system more broadly, whether it be the issue of chemical pollution throughout the planet. Like, literally, humans need a healthy planet to live on. There is no planet B. It's not just a sticker, it's a reality, you know. And the Greens understand that. And then also, I think I would say, I've always been somebody that really, my granddad and his whole family were deeply impacted by the Second World War, as you'd, like, imagine, coming from the UK and being of that generation. But my uncle Gordon, some of Pop's brother, was lost in the Second World War. He went out on a bombing run in 1944 and never came back. They never found his body. There was no closure because of that. And his loss, yeah, it was awful. It was awful. And he visually, physically looked very much like me. Right. So there was always that picture of Uncle Gordon on the wall, you know, and that deep, quiet sadness in Pop's family because of his loss. And I think that was the spark point for a real belief that people should, politicians particularly, should never send people to die in wars because it serves their political purpose. And we should always try, and leaders should always be working to resolve conflicts peacefully, you know, and never adding fuel to that fire because it's good for a poll or a headline. And that commitment to peace and non-violence in conflict resolution is something the Greens are really committed to too. So it's probably those three things together that pointed me in the Green direction.
Yeah, it's like bringing that up in regards to war. It's funny how, you know, intergenerational trauma can come in different forms. Like, you know, like with myself, I'm, you know, a fair-skinned Koori, I'm Wanneroo Kamilaroi, but on the Wanneroo side, my grandfather went through the Stolen Generation, and just how I've just seen that impact, you know, my family, and I've got a pretty large mob, but also how it affects the rest of these mobs, as you can see in the amount of different tribal nations across the country. But, you know, where whether it's war or if it's other sorts of conflicts within family units and how that can trickle down, but how that, you know, either suppresses or either that makes voices louder and throws that fire in the belly. And, you know, in your case, in my case, it's keeping those wheels and, you know, keeping up that perpetual motion moving forward. And that's super important. And just how's it been in general? Like, it seems like, you know, it's almost the length of time that you've spent in politics for your age. It's almost like a lifetime, you know, what you've seen in change. Like, and how's that been from, you know, from the lens from a Greens perspective? And hey, did any, before you got into the Greens, were there any other political parties that were trying to put some sweet whispers in your ears to try and get you in their camp or what?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting question because originally my whole family was Labor, and I was going to join the ALP, or at least get involved with the ALP. I was very excited when Kevin Rudd was elected, although that was mostly because John Howard was kicked out. But, you know, that was quite exciting. And it was an amazing time. You had, you know, Howard come to an end in Australia, Obama elected in the United States. And, yeah, I was going to go down that Labor route, and then the Labor government started making decisions that I just couldn't support. Like, and I think the breaking point for me, like, I was really disappointed when they failed to work with the Greens to pass the emissions trading scheme in 2009, and then when Rudd was knocked off, that didn't sit right with me, even though I was happy that Australia finally had a female prime minister, and that was fantastic. But it seemed like the person we'd voted for, you know, we hadn't got past the opportunity to pass judgment on one way or another. And particularly, it was really irritating to me that, you know, people were either struggling to get what they needed, or there was so much opportunity to do good things, and it seemed like it was being wasted because they were fighting each other. You know, Labor was tearing each other apart internally, and that was not good to see. But then the final straw came when the Gillard government proposed something called the Malaysian solution, which was a proposal to send a bunch of refugees to Malaysia in exchange for Australia taking a bunch of refugees from Malaysia. And I just thought, nah, that's just people swapping. Like, there are desperate people coming across the seas, need our help. We have a legal obligation to help them, and we've got enough capacity to do it. We should just be saying, come here, get dry, what do you need? You know, and let's help you build your life in this country. So I was like, nah, to that. And the only party that was speaking that same truth and saying so clearly that we should be, that politicians should be being more compassionate towards refugees, was the Greens. So I kind of joined and didn't look back.
Yeah, well, we do have a massive continent, like the amount of land mass, like when you look at what we've got here, and when we look at the states, like where we're nearly, you wouldn't say on par, but when it's going from, you know, east to west to north to south, and you're looking at their population, we, you know, looking towards going 27 million, and they're, you know, 330 odd. and and where there's a lot of space for a lot of mob here. Doesn't matter if you're black, white, or brindle, you know?
Yeah.
So, which is...
We've got to recognize that. We also have to recognize the uncomfortable, it's an uncomfortable truth, but it is a truth, which is that since the foundation of colonial Australia, there have probably been two cultural factors that have been present since the beginning, still present now. Systemic racism, deep racism, and deep misogyny. Those are the two things that I always think of as the two things that landed on the shore in the coming of the first fleet and were the foundation stones of Australian colonization, were those two deeply held ideologies. Now, each generation that's come forward has in some ways challenged, pushed those realities and attempted to create in one way or another a society and a community that is not so dominated by those factors. But in every generation also, people in positions of power, politicians, have for their own purposes stoked those feelings and those ideas for their own ends, to either to divide people, to dilute their power, or to build power for themselves. And the conversations that both sides of politics indulge in now about refugees is a continuing example of people in political decision making positions in Australia stoking and sharing racist ideas for their own personal ends. There's no reason why we need to be locking people up on Nauru or Manus Island. There's no reason why we should have such discriminatory immigration laws or make it so difficult for people to come here. The reason that those policies and processes exist is that politicians on both sides have decided that they're an easy way to distract from failings of theirs in other areas. Because while we're all worried about the boat people, we're not thinking about how much money the Australian government is giving to mining corporations every year, or how much we are subsidising property developers in this country to overheat our housing market and make it impossible to get a house.
Straight up, 100%. So, and that's what's super frustrating with, you know, the political gameplay and when it's got to do with personal ideals and just, and it's hard when you've got that balance of power and when you're looking at situations for what they are, and where there's things that make logical sense. And, yeah, you got to peel them back because, you know, it's a lot of people here. There's a lot of different facets to it. But, you know, you can make things work. And, you know, it's good when the voices of many do pipe up and when that can, and especially now with social media, and that can be positive but a hindrance too. But it's good when it does, you know, push forward. So you do start to get momentum from those voices that weren't heard too long ago to now that are making some waves in the political field and making some sway, you know. So how is it in regards to, like, how has it been? And especially initially when you, because this happens in all different sectors of when it's got to do with jobs, right? And when it's got to do with ableism and occupations, and does it, and it, you know, it still happens when you're in the people working within the disability sector. So, but just like with yourself, like having CP, cerebral palsy, being in a manual wheelchair, and just wheeling through the halls of parliament, and just the acceptance of your peers. You know, whether that's the party that you're in, you know, or the other individual parties that you're working with when you're in Canberra or wherever you are across the nation. And just when it's people taking you seriously, like, I know what it's like being for myself, like being in different sectors and doing X, Y, and Z. And when I've talked to individuals being in other sectors that aren't disability related, or, and just, you know, when it's just people just taking them seriously for what they got to say, and, you know, especially when they do have a loud voice and things do make perfect sense coming across. But when it's that whole ableism, it's that, you know, it's already sitting in their subconscious before the person wheels or walks through the door. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And ableism is, we've got to acknowledge the reality, right? That ableism is a massive problem. Yeah, in our community, it really, really detrimental. Like, it makes life so much more difficult for disabled people. And it's often, rather than being challenged by people with positions of power, it's often actually promoted, you know, either explicitly or implicitly in how people with microphones, you know, figuratively or actually, you know, in the moment, speak about us or don't speak about us, or, you know, the kind of myths that are reinforced rather than challenged. I would say that, first of all, that I would say that I have been very lucky, and I want to acknowledge my privilege straight up front, right? I'm a disabled person, proudly a disabled person. My disability is physical. I've got a physical disability, cerebral palsy, and I now work in a job where I am lucky enough to work as part of, a broader MP team of 15 Greens MPs, but specifically in my office here, I've got 7 fantastic people who are part of our office team. And 2 of those folks are disabled people as well. And we've done a lot of work together as a team to build a shared understanding of what are we here to do. And part of that very much is challenging ableism and, you know, and pushing it out. And also, how do we want to work with each other in a way that is accessible and inclusive? Many, many disabled people do not get a chance to do that, let alone to be financially supported to do that in a way that an MP is. So with all of that privilege and specialty context acknowledged, what I will say to you is that it has been at times really, really difficult from a disability perspective. That building, Parliament House, is not accessible for disabled people, and the people who run it have and the you know, the bureaucracies around it have been very slow to move and change and respond to the needs of not only myself and my team as disabled people in that space, but to actually look at the bigger picture, and actually what does it look like to create an accessible and inclusive workspace. Now, finally, after 5 years of pushing, they are doing a disability access and inclusion review and putting in place a new strategy to tackle these things, and that's good. Although I'm always somebody that thinks that strategies are only as good as their implementation plans and the extent to which those implementation plans are resourced. So you know, we'll wait. I'll keep pushing to make sure that not only do we have a strategy, but we also have an implementation plan and a resourcing envelope that sets that up to succeed. Why that's so important, though, is that this is literally the space that writes the laws, or indeed fails to write the laws, that actually will take on so much of the work of ending ableism in our society. And if that very space, you know, the doors are too narrow, or they don't open, or the carpets are too thick, or bells go off continually, so they're completely, you know, not a workspace for somebody with auditory or processing issues. There's no cultural awareness around neurodiversity or around the ways in which to work and include people with intellectual or cognitive disabilities. If there's no way for a deaf MP to contribute to a parliamentary debate, or a blind MP to navigate the halls safely, That's not okay. That's an inaccessible workspace, and it has to change.
God, sure it does have to change. And, mate, if you got job access on it from WA out of there, that'd be a bit of a bill that they'd have to park aside to get get it all ripped apart up Canberra up there or wherever that you're residing within Parliament. But, no, there is a lot that has to be done in regards to whether it's, you know, access, whether it's got to do with people that acknowledge individuals with disability, you know, and the seriousness of it. You know, it's not looking at, you know, less of, you know, which can, it is harsh, but it does happen. And some of the stories that I've been told when people are working with their colleagues and just what comes across, but, and then you're looking at that from the mental side of things, but when you, the physical side, just access to premises, you know? So there's so much that, massive, huge. Like, you know, I also come from a building background and anything under AS 1428, like, and I'll get into that later, but because that does my head in and there's a lot that needs to be done there. But, and because we're not that old of a country. So, and just the way things that need to be retrofitted and all the rest of it. And, but just the power of money that can come behind that to make a difference isn't a whole lot. There's just ways and means to make things work. And the thing is, if you make it accessible, yes, you got that person coming through, whether it's vision impaired or if it's sensory or if it's the physical aspect of it, wheeling in a chair. But then, you know, that person, that elderly person with the mobility aids or the mum with the pram, you know, it's also creating that space for them as well that makes it a little bit more accessible. So we crossed over there looking at ableism and what it's got to do with the workplace, and, you know, that could be a whole bloody couple of hour podcast in itself. But want to jump into your portfolios, right? So, and you cover a lot of very important ones here when you're looking at health, when you're looking at disability rights and services, when you're looking at foreign affairs, peace and nuclear disarmament. So,
yeah,
mate, that's a heavy toll there, a lot on the shoulders. But that's plenty for you to keep up and, you know, keep wheeling along and making sure that you're getting the positives firing off. So, but also pulling out the negatives and seeing what, you know, how things can be, you know, deliberated and, you know, best forged to move forward. But one close, you know, I know it's to yourself, to me, a lot of individuals out there and, you know, myself, like this is just putting out that out there to the folks, like, you know, I'm a C5, C6 incomplete quadriplegic, you know, I have been for 14 years, acquired disability. I'm, you know, a proud advocate. I'm an NDIS participant and also own and run my own NDIS service provision company in the disability sector and fall into different state and territory disability schemes and whatnot, but, you know, and it's a tricky field, and you can see, you know, like the expansion with the NDIS, and I've seen a lot of positives, I've seen a lot of negatives, and it's just been tricky and at times been a bit of a minefield for a lot of vulnerable individuals out there in the field. So, and
very much so. 100%.
So, and because I know with and it's the hashtag on your website when it's fix the NDIS, Jordan. So,
yeah,
where do we start? So I've got a few questions to fire off, but I'll let you, you know, hit some of the hot topics in this massive scheme within the disability sector.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we look exclusively at the NDIS, right, there's a couple of key things that we as disabled people have been saying for a really long time that are ways in which the scheme is working right now that need to shift so that it works better for us. One really simple one is there needs to be when you need to change something about your plan, when you need to reach out to the agency for any reason, you should be able to do that, to speak to a human being that has a knowledge of you, that has a knowledge of your situation, your circumstances, your supports, and then you can work together to solve the problem, right? And that's the original design intent of the NDIS. You were meant to have your own planner who was a decision-making delegate who you worked with directly. That's how it worked in the trial sites. So that if there was a problem, you could ring them up and tell them. And over time, you were able to build a relationship and to build trust with that person so that you can have that relationship. They can build that understanding of you. And ideally, they would have, you know, a background or a base of knowledge relevant to your disability type or your support needs, right? So that's number one. That's what we need to do. And that involves hiring more people, many more people than the government has suggested hiring so far. And we need to make sure that they are disabled people, as many disabled people as we can hire to be part of this scheme, working on the other end of it, the better.
100%.
Yep, absolutely. And we need to make sure that those people are trained properly and supported, paid properly, and supported to engage in proper professional development. And if we do that, that'll mean that on the participant end, you're able to pick up the phone, speak to the person that you know about the situation they already understand, resolve any issues that may exist, and work together to achieve your goals within your plan. On the employee side, what that would mean is that you're working in a professional, supportive workplace where you're working with intent and good job satisfaction, because you're building the relationship and you're seeing the outcome of your work as people get the supports that they need. So that's number one. And by the way, that's got to be supported by a IT system that actually works. Because at the moment, the ICT system asks you to do silly things like listing your primary disability when there is no such thing as a primary disability. It also asks you to prevent you from doing things like accessing a draft of your plan before it is complete. So we need to be able to enable people to see a draft of their plan before it is signed off and becomes their final plan. So that's number one. Number two, what we need to do to fix the scheme is we need to have a fundamental culture shift within the agency. And this is a hard thing to do, and it's hard to measure, but it's very, very important here. We need everything the NDIS does to be shaped by an understanding of the social and affirmative models of disability. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean is, and some of your listeners might be familiar with it, but in case anybody isn't, there are, over the decades, disabled people and academics and researchers have come up with different models of how to think and talk about what does it mean to be disabled. And they've landed on a couple of different names for those models. So you've got the medical model of disability, which is the most common one. Then you've got others like the social model of disability. And now the kind of cutting edge or the newest thinking is around the affirmative model of disability and disability pride. Now, the medical model of disability, which is the most used, sees disability as being the result of somebody's brokenness or their non-conformity.
Yeah, I'm hearing you.
A norm in society. So they would look at somebody like me and they would say, well, you know, your disability is cerebral palsy. You've got an injury in your brain. It means you can't walk and do some other things. And therefore, you're a bit broken. You don't really fit. The normal people might make some adaptations for you, a ramp here, a parking space there. But ultimately, the onus of change is on you. in the medical model of disability to adapt yourself to the normal society. Whereas the social model of disability flips that on its head.
That's right.
And it sees disability as the product of the interaction between a impairment or a difference with barriers created and sustained in society by ableism. So it would say, yes, Jordan, you've got CP, it means you can't walk and do other things, but actually the barriers you experience as a result of that are a product of these external factors. Mm. And therefore there is a collective responsibility between the disabled and the, you know, rest of the community alike to work together to bring down those barriers so that everyone can participate and be included. And the best way to explain this is the medical model looks at a person in a chair before a flight of stairs and goes, too bad, so sad. You know, you can't get up the stairs. And the social model says, well, who the hell's idea was it not to fit a lift? So, like, there's that shift. The affirmative and pride model says, actually, builds on the social model and says not only is a disability the product of those barriers, but it is also a social identity of which disabled people can be proud. In the same way as being a queer person is an identity of which queer people can be proud, or being a black person is somebody, something that you can be proud of as an identity, so too being disabled. And through that shared collective pride, power is possible through that shared identity. So what we need the agency to do is to move from a medical model and chuck that in the bin and embrace the social and affirmative model of disability. And why this is so important is because that would mean that your planner would sit down with you and go, okay, you know, I'm looking here and you're saying you need all these supports in your plan. Well, okay, that seems reasonable and necessary to me, because it's our responsibility to provide you with the tools to navigate the barriers that society has put in place or left there, rather than go, oh, come on, Jake. Are you sure do you need all of those support hours, mate? You know, are you sure you couldn't manage a bit of it on your own? Like, you know, and any frustration or, oh my God, this costs too much, actually in the social model gets put with the society for building the inaccessible space in the first place, rather than with the individual for costing too much to be in it.
100%. You know, that's it starts with the planner, but then that scales, you know, with the amount of individuals throughout the country, and where that scales up and you got the treasurer's balance sheet there, and it's like, oh, well, if we go from medical and if we go to social or other, you know, that's going to add a few more zeros there, you know, if it comes down to dollars and cents. And that's what a lot of things come down to, which is a shame, but it shouldn't be looked at that way. You know, if things...
No, it shouldn't.
No, and it drives me nuts. Like, you know, where I've seen planners where they're trying to, like, they do not know nothing about physios, and then they're trying to tell that individual, this is like an individual with a physical disability that's in a wheelchair, of how much physio they should need, when they know nothing about it. They don't have the clinical expertise, know nothing, but they've just decided to put that in place. You know, and that's
ridiculous.
You know, and then that puts a major handbrake on that individual with a disability, on their development, you know, physically, and then that weighs down on that individual mentally, and then it's just ongoing and ongoing and ongoing, and that happens in so many different facets with so many disabilities, and it's just putting a handbrake on the system, you know? So
it really, really is, my friend. And the last thing I think we need to do, and this is a pretty radical idea, you might want to strap yourself in for this.
Throw it in there.
I think we should have a disability minister in Australia. And I think that that person should be a disabled person. And I, from what I see in Parliament, so many of these problems of not only how the NDIS works, but also how does healthcare work, how does housing work, how does education work, all of these things are a product of there not being one person and one ministry whose job it bloody is to coordinate the whole of government response to making everything more accessible and inclusive to people. We used to have one decades ago, but in this Labour government, they decided not to have one. I think that was a real mistake, just having Bill Shorten in the NDIS space, because it's about more than just the NDIS. We need a fully coordinated response so that people don't fall through the cracks.
100%. And that's, you know, that's stuff where I see it federally, or this is also where I see states and territories, and yep. when it's got to do yep. with the different health systems, and where it's almost you got health and disability is the lesser of, like, it's the forgotten
yep.
part about this whole scenario, even though, you know, they should, it's one of the same. But then you're looking at the magnitude, how big the NDIS is now and where they're blowing it out. So you're going to need all these individuals working in the field. You're going to need, you know, when it's got to do with training up, education. Hey, and there's no shortage of people acquiring disabilities or born with disabilities every day. Like, that's not going to, that ain't slowing down. So it's got to be, and that's where it's got to be looked at, like health, you know. So it's got to be its own channel, and it's got to have, you know, where you got the tip of the spear, and hey, maybe one day that's you, brother, or who knows. And then you've got,
and then you've got
all the support and mechanisms around that, and where you've got more individuals within government, whether that's federal with disability or lived experience, because you've got a lot of mothers and fathers out there too that have got kids, brothers, sisters, partners with disability, that get where that whole ripple effect rings true.
Mm-hmm.
Mate, and that's where I've seen people like that, where they've got that lived experience, whether it's that person with a disability themselves or that person with lived experience. And when I'm looking at certain situations with, you know, whether if it's state or federal matters, it's like, why are you paying these consultants that where you've, when you could have figured it out in less than half the time with these individuals right here that get it, that are on the ground?
Yep.
They know it, and they could have knocked it on the head, bang, thanks for coming. But you're throwing X amount of dollars to the so-called experts because, you know, there's a lot of that drives me nuts too. But, you know, there's
– me too.
Yeah.
Me too.
You know, so, radical idea, but the thing is you got to throw that stuff to caution to the wind. You know, otherwise you don't make change.
And really, I was being a little bit sarcastic there, mate, because I don't actually think it's a radical idea at all. We have in this country, and we should have, a Minister for Women who's a woman, and a Minister for First Nations Affairs that is a First Nations person. There should be a disability minister who is a disabled person.
Yep.
And it's as simple as that.
Yeah, because you do see similar formulas, how they run things in other countries, you know. So when they've got that, you know, that person with a disability or that's akin to it in some sort of way, so they channel that person's expertise that, yeah, they've got that lived experience within that field and they've got the academic chops to go with it. Beauty. They know what's going on.
Fantastic.
They're just going to add, like, positivity and logic sense to the matter and help break it down with the other individuals that where the expertise should lie within their background knowledge. And, hey, those people aren't always easy to find, but there's a lot of diamonds out there in the rough. A lot of them.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, mate. And so, you know, and I've heard you get fired up about this topic, and I want to get you to explain to the viewers and listeners like what an ADE is. An ADE is in the community.
Yeah.
And just what they are, how they operate, and I can sort of jump in and get into it with you too, obviously, because I've got my irks about it, and there's, yeah, it's a hard one, that one, but I'll let you kick it off there, brother.
Well, I think we should start with the baseline, right, that I think most people, nearly everybody in our community would both accept and expect when it comes to work. They would say that everybody should be paid the minimum wage, you know, at least the minimum wage as a floor. You know, we should then be able to go above the minimum wage for whatever enterprise bargaining agreement we're under, or specialty that we have, or agreement that we might reach as part of our collective workplace. I'm a big supporter of, you know, creating more pathways for people to join unions and collectively bargain and all those kind of things. But the one of the great kind of baseline safety nets of Australian society is the minimum wage, right? And it's set based on what in an independent tribunal believes is what is needed so that if you earned it, you could reasonably expect it to be able to live, right? And there's an exception to that, though. There's an exception to that, and it's called the Australian Disability Enterprise. And these are structures that these are programs and structures that exist where disabled people, instead of being paid the minimum wage, are paid far less than the minimum wage. And they are paid far less than the minimum wage because their wage is subject to a special calculation called the BSWOT, isn't it? It's the BSWOT mechanism, which stands for supported something wage tool. Basically, it's a calculation tool. But what they do is they go, well, this is what you'd be paid if you were a worker in any other industry, but we're going to calculate how less productive you are because of your disability, and then we'll pay you based on that rather than what you should be paid as a worker in the broader community. It's so discriminatory. Can you remember the proper acronym name for the tool, Blake?
Hold on. That's doing my head in now. Stand by.
We'll find it, folks. This tool is literally discrimination incarnate because it accepts the premise that the disabled person's inability to perform the task is their fault rather than the result of the employer's unwillingness to adapt the job so that the disabled person can do it. And what this means in real kind of real terms for people listening along at home is that you've got disabled people that are paid for doing, you know, manual jobs sometimes. They're paid 80 cents an hour, $2.50 an hour. $3 an hour if you're lucky. If that, folks. In WA, we've got a provider, an ADE operator, that somehow, through their own particular brand of administrative evil, managed to steal the wages of those workers to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars, underpay workers. And this flows through to your super too. You ask some of these providers, do they pay super? And their answer is, we're not sure. We think so, maybe. We'll get back to you, and then they never get back to you. So what is the issue here? The issue here is, at its height, this was about 20,000 people that were kind of in these programs, and this was federally subsidized by the national government too. This was public money that was being spent to maintain these programs where people were, so you're basically paying, and then as an NDIS participant, some people have them funded in their plans. So you effectively pay through your plan
to be underpaid. So you pay someone to underpay you, which is...
That's what drives me nuts. Yeah, absolutely wild. And going back to it, but the B-SWOT is a business service wage assessment tool, combines an assessment of productive output with a competency assessment which measures the employee's skill, qualification, job knowledge. No, you got to meet the bar of your people. I've seen plenty of people that when it's working in these ADEs and like they're churning through. It's not just a place to go and have a chat. Yeah, people do go there and find meaningful friendships, and they might have an intellectual disability and might not understand so much. But the thing is, like when they get direction from their foreman or whatever, and it's like, hey, can you pack X amount of boxes or whatever it may be? And it's just, you know, they're putting their six... They're having a crack, putting their 6 hours in. You know, I'm talking 6 hours, 5 days a week, 4 days a week, you know?
Mm.
It's insane. And then, like you said, it's funded within that person's plan for that, you know, which could be, you know, 16, 20, 30, you know, talking thousands of dollars that goes to an ADE, it's almost like a weird sort of double dipping situation in a sense. So
it really is, and so in my view, this is what we need to do, and it's one of my biggest bugbears with the federal government at the moment, because it's really clear that this form of discriminatory treatment of disabled people is not okay. It's not resulting in good pay for people. And increasingly, younger people are deciding they don't want to go into these services. And so the older people or the middle-aged people that have been in there for a decade or more, there are fewer and fewer people coming, and these for-profit providers are saying, well, we don't operate them anymore. So what we need, what we really urgently need, is a transition plan, right, to support the workers that are there to transition from these ADE environments either into mainstream work where they are supported to do that mainstream work, or what we need to do is look at how do we increase the disability support pension so that it is enough for people to live on while they are also supported to do any and other activities that will give their, by their own definition, give their life the meaning and purpose and social interaction that comes with, that some people find in these settings. So we need to do that, and that can't happen quickly. We do know that it'll take a couple of years to do this successful transition plan. We don't want to do it overnight, because some people have been in there for 30 years and, you know, change their environment and their support structure.
That's the hard thing. That's
a distressing thing for people.
Yeah, and that's where you knocked it on the head, like in on both camps, right? When you're looking at the people that have been in those environments for years, and if they got the types of disabilities where if you start changing and shifting things in a rapid pace, like it's just, you know, because if it's autism or some other types of disabilities, and then it's not going to agree with the way that their day operates. And if they do have, and they're familiar with that environment and they've been there for 20 years, but then you're going to hurt the ADEs in the long run, because like you said, you've got all these youngsters that are coming through with disabilities going, nah, I don't want to work there. Why would I go and do 25 hours when I'm seeing my brother do the same thing, and how come he's buying all this cool stuff? How come he can afford to go out and rent with his friend? Or how come he can go, you know what I mean? Like, just the imbalances out of there.
Absolutely. And government has known that this is wrong for decades. They've known that this is wrong for decades. Countries all over the world have transitioned away from and then prohibited these forms of work. And my criticism and the Greens' criticism of the government right now is that they are not providing that clear, definitive leadership saying, we want to end this practice. We know that it's going to take a couple of years. Here's the transition plan for that. But we are building an Australia in which this does no longer exist. Instead, they're trying to have a buck each way, you know. Oh, we'll develop some social enterprises over here. But, oh, you know, maybe we'll fund the ADEs to keep going over here. And that's not okay, because that will just end up with another generation of disabled people sucked into these systems. And treated often quite badly within them. We've got to prevent that.
100%. And that's where I've been thinking about that for a long time, especially when you're looking at the DSP and raising that bar so you're meeting some sort of level playing field. And if you got, because some of these ADEs, you know, if they're fairly large and they're warehouses and whatnot, which a lot of them around the country are. So, well, it's, yep. You know, well, what can be worked out between, you know, when you do get a contract that lands with that ADE, like, can't things be worked out within, you know, it's the people, when you're looking at the head contract and looking at the, you know, the DSP and what goes on, like, there needs to be some sort of bargaining agreement that needs to be worked into it, you know what I mean? So
there's also some really simple things we could do right now, like allow people to earn more money before their DSP starts to reduce. So, like, at the moment, if you work more than 14 hours a week, at 14.5 hours a week at full-time wages, from that point on, your DSP decreases. So the Greens think that you should be able to earn more before your DSP increases. In acknowledgement, decreases, rather. In acknowledgement,
yeah, that's true.
Many disabled people, for physical reasons, energy reasons, actually can't work a standard full-time job. You know, like, it's that partial employment that actually fits their energy needs. So you've got to make sure that they can do that while also having enough money to live. So we could do that. We could make it so that you could earn more before your DSP began to decrease. And then also we need a proper disability discrimination framework in Australia and a legal regime in Australia that allows a disabled person who is discriminated at work to flag that with the Disability Discrimination Commission and have a body that forces the changes. Because the elephant in the room here is not that the employers, oh, we'd love to employ disabled people if only we could be supported to do it. They actually don't want to, because they think it will be too much trouble. And the message that we have to give them is, yeah, let's give you some information and support, that's fine, but you actually don't get a choice. No. You don't get to go, nah, we think that'll be too hard. Because we actually don't allow you to do that anymore based on gender or based on race, even though they do still hugely do that based on gender and race.
100%.
But at least it's acknowledged that that's what is actually occurring, rather than this, oh, it's so hard, we don't quite know how to do it. Bullshit. You have a responsibility not to discriminate against people when they are making employment applications. That's the law. And that doesn't suddenly vanish because the person's got a disability.
So you hear that, Graham Innes? Don't retire, brother. We need you still fighting, adding firepower to the DDA and all things to the legal structure. But no, seriously, yeah, so he's done great work, and it's been good to see some of the other people that are coming underneath him. And it's individuals like yourself and other people within legal frameworks, and we need to build upon that. Because, and me going back to thinking about with the DSP going up, and it, you know, it does make sense when you're talking about where it comes down and like the DSP come down and earn more dollars and cents. But I'm always thinking about, like, just in case something happens to that individual, so making sure that you're still linked to the DSP in case something happens, you've got a fail safe. So
absolutely, absolutely. Hey, look, Jake, I've got to go, my friend. I've just noticed the time, and I've got to get into my next meeting. So we'll have to leave it there. But it's been fabulous to talk to you, my friend.
See, folks, solid yarn with Senator Steele. Stripping back the NDIS. A man of lived experience. from his perspective, strong advocate, super passionate, no fluffing about, through his lens of where the NDIS should be. It's a massive scheme, represents millions of people, and there's no shortage of people being born or acquiring disabilities every day. Huge. So we need individuals like Jordan talking, broadcasting on behalf of people with disability, for the people that can and can't talk. Really important. And I could have kept talking to that bloke for hours, but being a politician, small windows of time. And I'm really appreciative of the time that he took to sit down and yarn up. But we'll have some juice too at the end of the year to yarn about for round two. Hey Jordan, love your work, brother. Keep it up. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe or follow button. And we've also got a Patreon page. The link is within the description. So if you want to roll with the squad and become a patron, that'd be great. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at streetrollandcheetah or email one word, streetrollandcheetah@gmail.com. And we've also got a Facebook page, Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs. So check it out. You can get me via LinkedIn, just Jake Briggs. And want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, we'll see you on the next one.